The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
You walk into a Jewish home, and the Torah somehow, and we'll get to this in a minute, but the Torah seems to be saying, this is what I want you to walk, this is what I want you to see when you walk into a Jewish home. Now, what do you think that should be? Forget your image of a mezuzah. Forget that. What would you expect? It is very important. You walk into an art connoisseur's home, they put a lot of thought into what painting is going to hit you when you walk into the house, how it's going to hit you, how the lighting is going to be. An architect creates a tremendous entrance because you know that's how you're going to judge his building or her building when you walk in. So now, here we go. God says, you walk into a Jewish home, what would you expect? We are now the Jewish Home Entry Committee. Okay? And we're deciding what should be. I mean, my children come into the house. And I want them to know you are not just coming home, you're coming into a Jewish home. So what do I do? What would you put there? Come on. What would you put there? What would you hang on the wall? What would you put in the entranceway? How should halakha determine this? This is very important.
Some reminder of Hashem.
Okay, so give me an example.
Star
of David. Well, that'd be a whole discussion because I'm not quite sure what the Star of David represents. That's an interesting question. Some kind of Jewish identity, you're saying. I have to be honest with you, I'd go further than that. Ten Commandments, now that'd be cool. Walk into a Jewish home, and thou shalt putteth thy Ten Commandments above the door. And by the way, just out of curiosity, I mean, if we're going to put the Ten Commandments up, by the way, what would be another good example of that? Give you a hint. The Shema! That'd be great! Put the verse, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, up on the doorway. Or maybe, Ve'ahavta lo'eicha kamocha, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. I can understand that also. Somebody comes into the house, talk to you right away, hi, I'm here, you know, like, love me, that I can handle. And by the way, since we're already talking about this, where would I put this? I mean, by the way, if we're really going to go all out, Torah scroll. Why shouldn't every Jewish home have a Torah scroll? Every synagogue has a Torah scroll. Do you know the king, there's a mitzvah for a king, a Jewish king, to write a Torah scroll, a small one, and to carry it with him wherever he goes. Jewish king has to have a Torah scroll on him. It's the only portable Torah scroll that we have. Has to be a portable Torah scroll, has to be in his pocket. Tremendous idea there, by the way. It's one of the few qualifications in the Bible for a king. It doesn't say, you know, you have to train him in swordsmanship. It doesn't say he has to be a marksman. It says he has to write a Torah. Tremendous idea. Especially when you consider this was written 3,200 years ago. That one of the basic qualifications for the king was that he had to write a Torah. And if he has to write it, he has to think about what he's writing. So that's a whole tremendous idea. So I would think every Jewish home should have a Torah scroll. There should be a little, you know, a little pedestal. There should be right in the entrance. There should be a Torah scroll. We should open it to an appropriate place. And that should be it. And I want you to know, if they'd done that, I'd give you a great class on it. Great class. Entrance to a Jewish home. They know there's a Torah scroll in the entrance to every Jewish home and it's open to this and isn't that incredible? And when you come in, you should be leafing through the Torah and it should distract you. But of course, I can't give you that class because they didn't tell me to do that. And if I'm going to put up the Ten Commandments or into the Shema, then where would I put it up? Pardon? On the door. Now think about that. Think about that for a second. How much time do you really spend at the door? I mean, where do you spend your time? Inside. Why do I put it outside? That's a little strange. No? I mean, I would think, put it on the wall. I mean, if I went to your home and I bought you a Rembrandt, and it's a magnificent Rembrandt, or a Renoir, right? And it's magnificent. I know there's one painting, it's an incredible painting. I have this old poster of it I had once up in my room, of a Dutch man. And he's dancing with a woman. I'm sure you know the painting, you would see it, right? It's a Rembrandt. And she's got this sort of half smile on her face. And he is obviously completely preoccupied with this. And I used to have this poster up in my room when I was in yeshiva. And once I got sick, and all I had to look at was this poster. So you can imagine I spent a lot of time thinking about this poster. And I think there's tremendous beauty in this poster. What's she thinking? What he's thinking? Isn't that the way a relationship should be? What's good about it? What's not good about it? Etc., right? So let's say you get the original and you give it to somebody as a present. And then you come a few weeks later and they've got it hung up outside their door. Are you mad? This is a Rembrandt. What's the matter with you? What are you hanging up outside the door? But that's what we do. So why is it outside? It should be inside. Strange. Go a stage further. Tell me what else is strange about this halakha that we call a mezuzah. Look at this thing over here. Okay? Before we get into exactly what it is. Right? So let's just take a look at what this mezuzah is. Okay? And this is actually better than most because there's a see-through piece of glass here and you can actually see the scroll. Most mezuzot don't have that. By the way, just as an aside, people make a mistake and they think that the mezuzah is the beautiful box. Right? Like I know somebody, a student here, who went to buy a mezuzah. They were all excited. They bought the mezuzah. And they wanted to show me the mezuzah that they bought. They'd gotten to me, and they bought a magnificent silver and gold, whatever it was, piece of art. Right? And they said, look, I bought a mezuzah. And I said, oh, it's really pretty, whatever. And he said, you know, I'm going to put it up, whatever. And I said, where's the mezuzah? And he said, what do you mean? I said, well, where's the cloth? Where's the parchment? He said, oh, I didn't know there was anything that went inside it. I just thought, you know, it was the mezuzah to put it up, which makes sense because that's what we see. I mean, the whole mezuzah, the whole thing that we call a mezuzah, which we'll get to in a minute, is not really this box. That's just the whole, what we're talking about. What's inside the box? Anybody know? Parchment. Parchment has the Shema on it. It's not all it has, but I won't get into that. We're not going to get to the details of the parchment because that would be a long discussion, right? But it has the Shema. Except that the Shema is rolled up inside, which is very strange. I don't even see it. If the Shema is so important, if the parchment is so important, then how come the parchment is rolled up inside so that I can't see it? Why don't I unroll it, put it up on the wall so I can see it? So why is it? Give me, by the way, another example of an occasion where I have this parchment and the message in the parchment is tremendous and I don't see it. Anybody know? Tefillin? Same thing. I've got these parchments in tefillin. You ask the average guy, the average person, what tefillin is. They'll tell you black boxes, etc., and there are parchments in there. What's in the parchment? Most people don't know. And you can't blame them. If I had, you know, there's a beautiful prayer. It's a prayer from the Talmud that you say when you enter the Beit Midrash, the house of study. I've been thinking for quite a while that we should get one and put it up here. But in the yeshiva where I was at, they had a beautiful one. And it was engraved, and it's the entrance of the Beit Midrash. I used to stop in the morning and read it. Shalo yikare takalal yadi, that through my learning and through my teaching, I shouldn't make a mistake and cause someone else to make a mistake. That the Torah that I study should bring peace to the world and not enmity. Beautiful, beautiful prayer. It's beautiful because it's there and you get to read it. So what is this? What is this idea? What is this concept called a mezuzah? And in order to do this, we have to take a look, perhaps, at two different areas, two different texts, okay, to get a picture of, you know what, we have Sidurim, this will be easier than Sidur. Where are all the Sidurim? But I will tell you, you know what, I'll take one, just so that you can then, I want to figure out first all the questions that we have about mezuzah, and then see what we're going to do about it, okay? First of all, I want you to know that the word mezuzah means literally a door jam. Okay? Uchtavtam, and you shall write them. We'll get to what them means in a minute. Al mezuzot beitecha, on the door frame, literally, of your home. Uvisharecha, and in your gateways. You're supposed to literally put it on the outside of your house. That's first of all. Second, does anybody know where the mitzvah of mezuzah comes from? Well, it's mentioned in the Shema, that's very true. Ooh, okay. Now that's interesting. Where's the first place we find mezuzah in the Torah? A door frame. Correct. Very weird. Very strange story. I'm gonna tell you. Very strange story. No, it's okay. Yeah, I've been away a week. You've gotten used to more organized people. That's okay. The Jewish people are in Egypt. It's the night literally before they leave Egypt. And God comes to Moshe, who then goes to the Jewish people, with a very strange request. He says, listen, you remember the lamb that I gave you, the mitzvah concerning, a few days ago? And I imagine Moshe says, yeah. Because the Bible tells me that God comes to Moshe and says, take a lamb, on the 10th day of Nisan, which was actually Shabbat in the year of the Exodus of Egypt, and on the eve of Shabbat, tie it up outside your house and let it sit there for a few days. And on the 14th day of Nisan, 4 days later, on the eve of Passover, because Passover, the night of Passover is the 15th of Nisan, on the 14th day of the month of Nisan, which is the first month in the Jewish national calendar, right? Take this lamb, slaughter the lamb. That's going to be for you a sacrifice. And it's called, anybody know? The Paschal sacrifice, right? The Paschal lamb. It's part of the Seder of Passover, right? And then do something else. Take the blood of this lamb and spread it on the door jamb. Why should you take the blood of this lamb and spread it on the door jamb? This is wild. Because I, says God, am going to go through the land of Egypt. And I'm going to bring a plague on every firstborn. And in order that I should be able to know that you or your home, or perhaps more accurately in the Bible, in order that I should be able to know, or my destroying angel, whatever that means, Hamashchit, should know that this house is a Jewish house, put the blood of the lamb on your door jamb. So now get this picture, okay? Just so we're clear on this. God's self, is going to go and bring this plague. God goes through the land of Egypt to bring somehow a plague on the firstborn. And God's afraid he's going to get confused. So in order not to get confused, he says, listen, put a mark on your door. But don't just write your name in a red magic marker. No, let's do something weirder. Take lamb's blood and put it on your door. And by the way, I'll get even stranger. Okay? Because there's a magnificent verse in Ezekiel, in Yechezkel. The prophet Yechezkel lived at the end of the first temple. He actually went down into exile. He was the only prophet that ever went into exile. He prophesied from Babylonia. And the prophet Yechezkel says, Va'omar lach, and I say unto you, Bedamayich chayi, through thy blood shall thy live. And this double blood, Va'omar lach bedamayich chayi, Va'omar lach bedamayich chayi, the Talmud tells me, don't worry if you're getting confused, that's good. The Talmud tells me that we're talking about two sets of blood. And that these two sets of blood somehow are what determined the future of the Jewish people. One of the bloods was the blood of the Paschal Lamb. And the other blood, anybody know where else we have something related to blood? Circumcision. Right? When a boy is 8 days old, I circumcise the baby child, and I have to do what's called hatafat tambrit. We have to bring out a drop of blood. Matter of fact, even if, for example, you know, this happened quite often in recent modern Jewish history, many Russian Jews who came from Russia, who'd never had a circumcision, sort of developed a relationship with their Jewish identity, decided that they wanted to be circumcised. But many of them were already circumcised medically, and because now that's the norm, they've discovered that it's healthy, right? But you still have to do some act in order to make a blessing. So they would take what's called hatafat tambrit, one drop of blood. It's not painful or anything like that, but whatever. So the Talmud goes a stage further. The Talmud says the entire Jewish people circumcised themselves before they left Egypt. And they took the blood of this circumcision, according to the Talmud, and they mixed it with the blood of the Paschal Lamb, and they put this on the door. Now, put aside for the moment whether this is literal or allegorical. It doesn't necessarily have to be literal, but it doesn't matter to me, even if it is. This is very strange. To put it mildly. I mean, I don't think I could find, if I really, really looked, a weirder topic to end Israelite with. Jews circumcising themselves, taking the blood, mixing it with lamb's blood, and putting it on their door jamb. Oh, come join us for a wonderful evening and see the beauty of Judaism. Hey, what's your dad doing? Oh, he's just putting lamb and circumcised blood on the doorstep so that the destroying angel will know we're Jews. Come on in! It's a little weird. This, by the way, is the first place that I find the concept of mezuzah, of the doorpost. So what is that? What is the doorpost? What is the Paschal lamb? What is the circumcision? How does this all relate to each other? And why to this day, as a result of that, am I putting a mezuzah on my doorpost? And I'll go you a stage further. Look, and I'm purposely doing in this sidur, so that you'll be able to do it on your own. Because I've noticed that a lot of you have sidurim, even though you don't have chumashim. But if you look, page 90? Okay. If you look in the Shema on page 90, thank you. Actually look in page 92 in the Sidur. You will find a very interesting thing. You'll find that it says, let's read the whole portion together, just to get a picture. This is the beginning of the Shema. You know, the Shema, and this as I mentioned, is contained in the Tefillin. Once I've gotten the first verse, which represents somehow the acceptance of a relationship with God, that there is a God, that God's involved in the world, right? That somehow that affects me as a human being, that I have to try to find a way to relate to God. That's what Shema really means. Listen, there's a God. And God is not just a God, but God is your God. Hashem Elokecha, right? Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem is our God. So then, what do I do about that? How is that relevant to me? V'yahavta at Hashem Elokecha, you shall love the Lord thy God. V'chol levavcha, v'chol nafshecha, v'chol me'udecha, with all your heart, and all your soul, and all your might. Now listen, there's a reason I'm reading you this whole paragraph. Listen to how these words work. And these words, what do you think these words mean? Give me two possibilities for what these words mean. Okay, one word is these words, that there's a God and that you should love God. What's another possibility? All these words, everything. That these words that I'm giving you, this Torah that I'm giving you, because this is said at Sinai, all of this. So either way you look at it, it doesn't matter to me for the moment. These things, Asher Anochi Mitzavcha Hayom, that I give you this day, in other words, the day of receiving of the Torah, Alev Avecha, they should be on your heart. Veshinantam Levanecha, and you should teach them to your children. By the way, the word Shinun is a strange word. What could I have said? Does anybody know another Hebrew word for teaching? Lilmod. Velimadtem. I would have thought I should say, you should teach them to your children. That's not what it says. It says vishinantem. The word shinun is a different type of educational method, repetition. You know, my daughter goes to a school, magnificent school, where they study certain things by repetition. They learn, you know, you'll see, for example, open up the Bible to any page, doesn't matter to me for the moment. If you look at the Bible, you'll see that there are all sorts of extra little markings, lines, that type of thing, right, that you find. Let me give you an example here. You look in Deuteronomy in verse 6, which is the Shema. So those of you who can read Hebrew, but if you're not, don't worry about it, right? You will see that there are extra markings. Like, for example, the word Shema itself is spelled in Hebrew this way. Right? That's the word Shema. The Shin. This is on page 218. It's the third line from the bottom. The right-hand word, Shema. And yet you'll see there's a little extra line here. You see that? See this little line here under the word Shema? Right? Now these are vowels. This is a Shva. And it you know, if I had this line here, this is called a Patach, I would say Shema. Because I have these two dots, I say Shema. Right? And those are vowels. This is a whole different thing. This is a cantillation. This tells me how to sing the word. This is called a tipcha. Don't get nervous if you forget these words. I'm just giving you an idea. Right? And there's a tune for these words. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. V'yahavta et Hashem Elokecha. V'chol levavcha, v'chol nafshecha, v'chol me'odecha. V'yayu hadivarim ho'ele. Asher anochi mitzavcha, hayom al levavecha. Now that's Ashkenaz cantillation. There's an older system of cantillation, which some say dates back to Sinai even, right? Which is Chaleb, which is from Syria and Middle East in origin. So my daughter goes to a school where they learn this. They learn these cantillations, these tunes. And as they're learning verses in the Torah, they sing them. And they sing them enough times until they memorize them. And she knows whole portions of Genesis. She just recently finished the book of Genesis. She knows whole portions of Bereshit, of Genesis by heart, just because she learned to sing them. Veshinantem levanecha means that you repeat them. You teach them in such a way that they're so on your lips and on their lips that they internalize them, which is a whole different level of teaching, right? Veshinantem. I would go you, by the way, a stage further. There's a beautiful, beautiful Hasidic vort. It can't be, you know, sometimes you find yourself as a parent saying, I have to find an hour to sit down and teach my children, whatever it might be, right? You know, I want to have an hour. Me and my son, we should have an hour to study. Me and my daughter and I, we should have an hour to study. Chassidus teaches, no. If you have to make an hour to teach your child something's wrong, you should always be teaching your child. It should be vishinandim. It should be so part of you that your child is learning the Shema because that's who you are. So, vishinantim levanecha, teach them to your children. V'dibarta bam, and you should speak in them. It doesn't say v'dibarta alehem, speak about them. Speak in them. Which is part of what I just said. Bam, in them could be the words. It could be your children. You have to speak inside to who they are, to their souls. There is no black and white box of teaching Torah to your children. Because how I teach Torah to Mayan is totally different from how I teach Torah to Yonatan. They're just different. B'shiftecha b'veitecha, when you sit in your home. U'v'lechtecha v'derech, and when you walk on the way. U'v'shachbecha u'v'kumecha, and when you lie down and when you wake up. In other words, I live Torah. I breathe Torah. When we're sitting in the car, we're studying Torah. When we're walking in the field, we're studying Torah. When my daughter goes to sleep at night, we're studying Torah. And when she wakes up in the morning, we're studying Torah. It doesn't mean that I wake up my daughter and say, Mayan, good morning. Bereshit bara Elokim et ha-shamayim v'et ha-aretz. No, that's not what it means. It means that everything that I teach about Torah has to be a reflection of how I live. If I teach my daughter that the Mishnah in Pirkei Avot says, have a kabel kol adam b'sever panim yafot, accept every person with a happy countenance. It's a mitzvah. When you walk in the morning, you meet somebody, that you should accept them with a happy countenance. You should say hello first. You should be happy first. You can give them a good day first. So if I'm teaching that to my daughter, then that has to be who I am. I can't just teach it and then do something different. Right? Everything the Torah has to teach me. Now it gets interesting. Ukshartam le'ot al yadecha, and tie them for a sign on your hand. And what's that? Tefillin. V'hayu l'tot tafot b'neinecha, and they should be an adornment between your eyes. Right? Uchtaftam le'mezuzot b'itecha v'isharecha, and write them on the door jamb, door post, it says here, of your home, u'v'isharecha, and in your gates. Now it gets interesting. So whatever this idea is that mezuzah represents, it's part of an educational process. It's how I'm going to teach my children. And I want to understand that. I want to understand how I got from sacrificing lambs to teaching my children. And what this has to do with the door jamb. I don't get it. And what does blood have to do with this? Such a negative thing. How do I understand that? Why is it that I don't see the message of the tefillin? Of the mezuzah? What's going on? And by the way, I'll go you a stage further just so you understand the significance of this. When you walk out of this class next time, take a good look at the mezuzah. And it happens to be that in this one that you'll see it quite clearly. But you will see this. Okay? You'll see a shin and a dalet and a yud. Right? That's what you'll see. And that is supposed to be on the outside of a portion of the mezuzah. Does anybody know what this is? It's one of God's names. But in fact, the Kabbalah teaches that this stands, okay, for a very important message. Shomer, the garter, right? Of daltot. Delet means door, of the doors. Yisrael, of Israel. The mezuzah is the garter of the doors of Israel. I want you to know, this is a very non-Jewish concept. That I put this talisman up on my door, you know, like, get the witch hazel and the broom, right? And the you know, make a little scarecrow, or put a devil's evil eye on the outside of my door and I'm safe. And yet you find this very often, and I gotta tell you. I'll tell you a quick story. Which I wouldn't have believed except that it happened to me. So I will tell you a story from a first-hand source. This does not affect my belief in God. It's not what I base my belief in God on. But it's the kind of story that when you tell it, you eventually start to hear other kinds of stories. And it certainly gives me a lot of food for thought. This is now about, I don't know, 3-4 years ago. We were living in a lunchbut before I moved to Efrat. And it was just like a month. It was one of those months. Every once in a while you have one of those months where just one thing after another starts to go wrong. I had it was more than 4 or 5 years ago. Whatever, it doesn't matter. I had one of my last tests for the rabbinate, etc. And the way I work when I used to study as a student is I write everything down. Right? I go through, I study and I write notes. And then I go through the notes and I write shorter notes. Until I finally have this shorter abridged version of notes. But by writing it over again and again and again and again, I memorize it. That's how some people, that's how I work, right? So about a month before my rabbinical test, I broke my hand. It was very weird. I was like running out of a room and I smashed, whatever, it doesn't matter. I smashed my hand. It's one of those super klutz moves. I broke my hand, right? Now, normally this is an annoying thing, but I couldn't write. A month before this huge set of exams, so it was like driving me nuts. I had to work with tape recorders and it didn't work for me, whatever, right? Then, about a week after that, I was driving home through Beit Lechem. They didn't have the new road yet. And someone threw a rock, a huge, it was unbelievable. This kid jumped out, took a block that was like this big, right? This is one of the reasons we now have a bypass road. And he didn't even throw it at me. He just threw it in front of the car. It was such a big thing, right? And unfortunately, I saw it about a minute before, about a second before it hit the car. So I went like this, right? Which is not a bright thing to do when you're driving, right? And I was sure this thing was going to go through the windshield, but I have like protective whatever on the windshield, right? So it didn't go through. It just cracked the whole thing. And I went into a pole. And thank God nothing happened to me. The car, on the other hand, was quite ill, right, as a result of this. And then about a week after that, we found out that something was wrong. We had gotten our house in Efrat. We couldn't yet afford to live in it. The bank still owned most of it, right? So we were renting it out to meet the mortgage payments and whatever. We found out there was something wrong with the pipes, and it could be we'd have to change all the plumbing, whatever. It was just one thing after another. And, I was like, this is this week's come home to Dorit and tell her, and find out what's going on, right? So I was sitting in yeshiva, and I was learning, and I was talking to whatever, Shlomo Levy, who's a very balanced, very rational, tremendous Torah scholar. And he finally says to me, and I sort of shared this with him at each stage. He says, have you checked your mezuzahs? Now that's the kind of thing that, in the circles that I was running in, you just don't expect to hear. This guy's an arch-rationalist. I said, no, I haven't checked mezuzahs. You should check mezuzahs. It's strange, all these things going on. Why don't you check mezuzahs? So first of all, if this tremendous Torah scholar, this is a guy who runs this whole program to develop rabbis, tremendous Torah scholar, Shlomo Levy, if he tells you to check mezuzahs, you check your mezuzahs. But I remember thinking to myself, okay, right. So I had 6 mezuzahs in the house, in the place we were in, the apartment we were living in. And there was a guy who was a scribe who works Ichermeyer in Alon Shva. And I happened to run into the bank, and I said, listen, whatever happened to me, these things, whatever. And Shlomo Levy said, I should check mezuzahs. So I think, whatever. He says, what? Bring them to me, but don't bring them all. How many mezuzahs do you have in your house? I said, I have 6. He says, all right, so bring me 3 this week and 3 next week, whatever, and I'll take a look at them, right? He wouldn't take money for it, for a scribe, it's not a big deal. You open it up, take a quick look. And he said, we'll see. Fine. So I go over to his little clinic where he's writing, he's a scribe, so he writes Torah scrolls, he's got all these parchments and ink and everything, and I bring him 3 of the mezuzah, right? There's a certain type of, there are different types of things that can go wrong with the scroll of mezuzah. And some of them are fixable and some of them aren't. You have to write the scroll of mezuzah in order. Rabbi Siegel is the expert on this, obviously, but you have to write the scroll of mezuzah in order. And so if there's a letter missing or something, then you can't just put in a letter because you have to write the whole thing in order. But sometimes you have a little ink sort of that spills and you have 2 letters that seem to be almost growing into one. You understand what I'm saying? If it hasn't yet happened, you can sort of scratch the edge or you can add a little bit of ink to the edge of the letter that's fading. And even though the mezuzah is invalid, you can revalidate it. So anyways, he opens up the first mezuzah. And he finds that on the words, Ukratam la'ot al yadecha, right, that you should tie them for a sign on your hand, right, that the 2 words, al yadecha, the word hand, it was a little running, so he fixed it. He said, oh, this I can fix on the spot, whatever, so he fixed it. Then he opens up the second mezuzah, right, and he sees that the same type of mistake, right, is on the words, al beitecha, on your house, right? So he fixes that one. Then he opens up the third mezuzah, and it says, uvelechtecha vaderech, when you go on the road. Same mistake, same type of thing, in the same place. So I look at him, right, like, whoa. He goes, listen, I don't believe in these Baba Mises. That's what he says to me. He says, don't start filling me with stories, whatever. So next week I brought him the next 3 mezuzah. And guess what? Same 3 mistakes, in the same 3 places. Scouts on it, this is what happened to me. How it just so happened that I picked these 3 mezuzot and those 3 mezuzot, and how it just so happened. So I want you to listen. And of course you tell these stories, every once in a while, I happened to run into somebody, and I was in Teaneck, New Jersey. I'll just tell you a second story, just to make my point here. I was in Teaneck, New Jersey that summer, and I was asked to give just to be clear, I went to a minyan. It was Shabbat afternoon, and the place I normally go to pray afternoon prayers, mincha, was too far, and we had a late Shal Shudah, so I went to this little minyan that was around the corner from the place I was staying in Teaneck, and I showed up there, and it happened to be that I had a couple students who happened to be in this place. And one says, "Wow, I can't believe you're here," and whatever. What? Listen, in between Mincha and Maariv, we have like a thing. We have a shiur. Would you give a shiur? Would you give a class? So I said, "Sure, you know, I'm here anyway. I don't mind. Fine." So I gave a class, and in the course of the class, I happened to mention this story. And I said that not only that, but the week after this happened to me, I was sitting with Rabbi Siegel. I ran into Natan Siegel the next week on a bus in Yerushalayim, and I told him the story. I couldn't believe it. I was amazed, right? And he said, "Oh, that's nothing. I'll tell you a story." And the story that he told me, which I was then repeating in Tinek, he said to me that he had a student who he had been teaching. And the student had a heart murmur, had an irregular arrhythmia, right? Something like an extra, I don't really understand these things, but it's like a disease which causes your heart to beat more than it should, like out of rhythm. And it can be very dangerous. They can give you medicine for it, but generally it involves an invasive procedure. It's a very serious thing. And this boy was here in yeshiva for the year, and he happened to discover this in a routine checkup or something, I don't know. And it was, you know, going to change his whole plans for the year. He had to go on medication, and he had to go to the hospital, and he wasn't, in terms of, like, I guess, the social medicine plan, whatever it was. So it didn't make sense for him to do it here, so he was going to have to go back to America to go put himself on whatever and possibly have an operation. And someone said, "Why don't you go see this rabbi? He's a Kabbalist, you know, maybe can't hurt." And he sort of went with the attitude that, I have to be honest, I might have gone with. He said, "Look, what do you know, so you spend a day with a Kabbalist, what could you lose, right?" So the Kabbalist, he walks in. This is the story that Rabbi Siegel told. He walks into this Kabbalist, and the Kabbalist looks at him, doesn't sit with him, doesn't talk to him, doesn't tell him anything, says, "Go check your tefillin." And he goes back to what he's doing. So he went to Rabbi Siegel. He said, "Listen, I have this whole thing going on. I was going to see a Kabbalist about this. I walked in, he said, check my tefillin. So I went to check my tefillin, but I don't know what's going on." So Rabbi Siegel said, "Well, I don't know what's going on, but, you know, I'll check your tefillin, you know, fine." So he opens up his tefillin, his hand tefillin. Turns out that on the word alivavecha, right, on your heart, you should put them on your heart, there's an extra bet. Instead of livavecha, lamed bet yudchaf, there's lamed bet yudchaf. Now with tefillin, you can change it, it's not a problem. With a mezuzah, you could. So he rubbed out the thing, you know, fixed it, or put in a new parchment, I don't remember exactly what he did. And a couple weeks later, the thing went away. Why do I tell you this? Because I was in Tinek, and this whole thing was very much on my mind. I was given the shiur. I don't remember what I was talking about, but I brought up my story, and I said, as a matter of fact, I heard an even different story, right? I told this whole story. This kid, who was a student of mine in Mevaseret, right, starts grinning from ear to ear, walks over to me after the class, because that's me. He goes, you know, right? And he told me how he was learning the Vesigal, and how he went to him, whatever it was. Anyway, so, these stories, they run around. And they don't change my relationship with God. But what is this thing? Like, what is this? If these kinds of stories go around about something, it means that there's something special about that something. And when I look at the dry facts on paper, I've got this parchment that sits inside a box that's given to me because once, 3,000 years ago, God went around and killed the firstborn of Egypt, and we put the blood of a lamb on the door. That's very strange. So I want to understand what this mezuzah is. And I want to tell you, when I looked at the schedule of this program and I realized I was going to be away for a week on reserve duty, I was coming back for a day, so I didn't want to have sort of a class a week and a half ago, and then finish up a class. I wanted to. What I love about mezuzah is it's really an item that you can encapsulate. You know, we talked a little bit about kashrut. We talked about Shabbat. These are subjects which are magnificent, but they're a little bit overwhelming sometimes. You could spend years studying Shabbat. Mezuzah, on the other hand, mezuzah is a mitzvah you can really take with you. You buy a mezuzah. There's one blessing. You put it up on the door, make sure it's kosher, and you've got your mitzvah. And if you do as I do, it's a beautiful custom that every time you walk by a mezuzah, you kiss the mezuzah, as if to say, I'm taking a moment to appreciate what this represents and what this means. Then every time you walk into your home, and every time you walk out of your home, you've got a mitzvah. I love that about mezuzah. And I want you to know, when you walk out of a class with me on kashrut, don't delude yourself into thinking that you've actually covered kashrut. Maybe I whet your appetite. But in terms of mezuzah, you can really get a pretty full picture, even though there's a lot more there. You could sit with Rabbi Siegel for weeks on mezuzah. But you can get a good picture of what mezuzah is. And that's what I want to try to do. In order to get in to the world of mezuzah, and to understand what mezuzah is about, we have to first understand the background that led to mezuzah. But it's important to bear in mind one thought in the background as we do this. Everything that we're discussing now in relationship to mezuzah is essentially the message that's given to me as I enter a Jewish home. And I got to tell you something interesting. Because it's not only when you enter the Jewish home, it's also when you leave the Jewish home. You know, Rabbi Aaron once said, we were sitting at an Israelite final party, and he made a really good point that I think really fits. You know, the doorway in Judaism represents transition. And transition is a difficult stage. Coming in, leaving. Some of us have more issues with transition, some of us have less. You come into a new place, some of us develop serious, what's called in Hebrew, charadot, fears, hesitations. And some of us don't really have them anymore, but they're in the background. But you know, it's like you go to a wedding. I remember one of the most wonderful things about getting married. So I suddenly realized I would never go to a wedding and wonder who I was sitting with. Because, you know, now when I go to, because it used to be, you know, you go to a wedding, so they put you at the singles table, right? Because like you're not a couple, right? So you're with the singles, right? So you don't know who you're sitting with. Since you know that when you're at a wedding, in Israel, sometimes you have weddings where they just kind of have like, you know, they'll put family on one table, family, and then they'll have singles, you know, and then they'll have like, you know, couples, right, and do it that way. And then you sort of have to go to a table that says singles, and sometimes you don't. But more often than not, I know, you know, in our wedding, so people plan a seating table. So you look around the table, you wonder to yourself, okay, here I am, I'm 23, I'm 24, I'm not married, right? Who did they want to set me up with? Right? Like, you know, you're sitting at a table, you're wondering, okay, who did they figure this out with, right? And sometimes you go to a wedding, you don't really know anybody, right? So there's like that moment of sort of like, oh, how are you, whatever. Some people, it's not a big deal. Like, I didn't, you know, have nightmares about it. Some people, it's a major issue. How to socialize with new people, et cetera. Departures. You know, you sit here, you're in a program like Israelite for 3 weeks. And I don't know how each of you felt, but, you know, I know that for me as a teacher, you get comfortable. You know, it's like there's a huge difference between the first day when you're here and you're at lunch, you don't really know anybody. And today you go to lunch, like, you know, you're comfortable, you can talk to anybody, everybody talks with each other, it's wonderful. Now all of a sudden you leave that comfort. You sort of have this greenhouse of Judaism, and it's wonderful, but it's not the real world. And now you're leaving that greenhouse, you're going back out into the world, that's not simple. What is it that is the last thing that you come into contact when you leave the Jewish home? You know, the Jewish home is an institution in Judaism. And it represents many things. And the Torah comes along and says, when you leave your home, this is what should go with you. When you come into a Jewish home, how do I know I'm coming into a Jewish home? What message am I supposed to get as I come into that Jewish home? Here it is. And that, by the way, is an incredible thing, that the same message that I'm given when I come into the home is the message that I have when I go out of the home, which makes it very important. So you have to bear that in mind in the background as we speak. Because everything that we're speaking about really is crucial because it determines what I get going in and what I get going out. So what is mezuzah? And what does it mean? And in order to understand this, I really have to give you a 5-minute synopsis, even though this is a whole class probably in the next course of studies, but a 5-minute synopsis of what the Paschal Lamb represented, what the blood of the Paschal Lamb represented, what the blood of circumcision represented, and why that was on the doorpost. Agree with me that it makes no sense to say that God needs a sign in order to be able to tell the difference between a Jewish home and an Egyptian home. That's absurd. So what does it mean? So let's take a look at how the Paschal Lamb works. And I'm only showing you this so that you can write yourself a note to take a look at this on your own, if you want to. You know, one of the things, and I terribly regret, unfortunately, the Israeli army did not play ball with me on this one, but I really do terribly regret the fact that we sort of had to cut the last week in half, even though you got a Ricardoza instead, so I have no qualms about the fact that you got a better replacement. But one of the things that I said 3 weeks ago was that I really wanted you to get an appetite whetter. I wanted you to walk away with a desire to be able to open up a book and to feel that you at least had what to work with. English or Hebrew didn't matter to me. So here's a present I'm going to give you. Because this is one of the most amazing chapters in the entire Torah. And I'm going to give you enough to whet your appetite. But if you look on page 76, this is chapter 12, Perek Yudbet, and it's verse 21. The first part, till verse 20, is what God tells Moshe, and then from verse 21 is what Moshe tells the Jewish people. Vayhi b'chatzi halayla, in the middle of the night, God is going to come, take every firstborn. And you look, at this chapter, it will tell you the following things. And I urge you, if you get a chance, study this chapter, because this is the beginning of the development of the Jewish home. So God comes along and says, I want you to take a lamb on the 10th of Nisan, in the day. And I want you to tie it up in front of your house. What does that mean? You know, the lamb was one of the seven gods of Egypt. Imagine for a moment what it must have been like for a Jew who'd been living in Egypt in a culture of slavery as a slave for 210 years, which is an incredible amount of time. I mean, when you think about it, that's since 1787. That's mind-boggling. And you talk about a slave mentality. I mean, most African-American families were slaves in actuality, without racism and everything else that went along with it, post-slavery, were slaves for 100 years, maybe. The overwhelming majority of the slave population in America in 1865 had come to America after. And God comes along and says, I want you to take this lamb,
and I want you to offer it up as a sacrifice to me. But I'm not letting you just take the lamb and sacrifice it. You're going to sacrifice it on the 14th. I want you to take it on the 10th. And I want you to tie it up in front of your house. Now what happens? For 4 days, with a lamb, the God of your master, tied up in front of your house. So the first Egyptian walks by, sees a lamb tied up in front of Hanani's house. What's the lamb doing here?
Oh,
don't worry.
We're going to slaughter it and sacrifice it on the 14th.
But you'll know when we did it.
You know how?
Because we're going to take the blood and put it on the door jamb. Now that's an incredible act. And what God is essentially telling the Jewish people is that you have to do something for me before you can leave Egypt. You have to show me that you're willing, that you're capable of getting Egypt out of you. You take the idol of Egypt and you slaughter that idol to me. And you take the blood, and it's very interesting, by the way. In idolatry, blood is a very central role. And an Egyptian idolatrous sacrifice, blood played a central role. In Judaism, blood is forbidden. Forbidden to eat blood. Matter of fact, even a kosher animal, in order to eat it, you first have to salt it so that all the blood is gone. No visible blood. You, Jew, the whole blood represents life, have to take the blood of that lamb, which was everything to you, because it was the idolatrous practice on which your entire culture was based, and put that on your doorpost. As if to say, here's the line. When you enter this home, and cross through this door, the lamb doesn't enter with you. That's a tremendous idea. And before the Jews were able to leave Egypt, they had to make that statement. And it goes, by the way, a stage further. The Pesach sacrifice,
Korban Pesach, the Paschal lamb,
was much more than just one more mitzvah. That was the willingness of each Jew, considering where they were coming from, to put it all on the line. To say that I'm willing to put everything on the line for something I believe in. That's why they put it on the door. It's interesting, by the way, we don't have time to go into depth into what circumcision represented. But that's exactly what circumcision is. That a Jew at 8 days old, as he enters the covenant and becomes a Jew, has to understand that there are certain things in life that are even more meaningful than life itself. Because the meaning that we give to life, the purpose of life, has to supersede life itself. The purpose of our life is not life. If the only reason that I'm here is just to live, then I'm missing something. The question is, what do I live for? And if I do develop a relationship with God, if I find that I have a loving relationship with something other than myself, then ultimately I'm willing to give up everything for that. By the way, that's the secret to the relationship of marriage. What does it mean to find the person? You know, I saw a beautiful vart, a beautiful Dvar Torah. It's quoted in the name, I forget the name of the Chassidic Rebbe, but from Rav Shlomo, Kalbach. How do you know when you found your life partner? If you find someone with whom you no longer feel alone, if you meet someone who, when you're around them, you want to be a better person, that's a good sign. But if you meet someone who, when you're around them, you already are a better person, then you know you found the person you're supposed to be. That's what it means to be in love. And that's the relationship I want with God. When I'm able to somehow concentrate and consider what God means in my life, I become a better person. I am a better person. I'm no longer alone. I want to be a better person. And so before I can leave my home into the world Judaism gives to me, I have to first establish what that home is. It's interesting that the Jewish people do that in Egypt. In the midst of Egypt, you can make a Jewish home. And you can say that over this line, certain things don't cross. When you enter this boundary, this is who I am. And that's what circumcision is, because as a Jew enters the world of Judaism, he basically draws a line in the sand. Now why, by the way, that's for a male baby and not for a female baby, that's a complicated issue. And there are many, many beautiful, beautiful ideas there. Not least of which, what specifically circumcision represents and how it relates to the weaknesses of the man in terms of desire, and how there's certain issues that a woman doesn't have to deal with because she's a part of a life cycle, etc., something we once spoke about. So we don't have time to get into that now, but that has very much to do with it. So that's where mezuzah begins. Mezuzah begins, the concept of the Jewish doorway begins when the Jewish people respond to God's query. When Hashem comes along and says, I'm ready to take you out of Egypt. Are you willing to take yourselves out first? And it's interesting. We celebrate the Passover Seder on the night of the plague of the firstborn. When we were still in slavery. We weren't yet free. Makes no sense. We should have celebrated it the next morning when we got out of Egypt. Perhaps it's because that's when we really achieved our freedom. Freedom is not whether I'm in Egypt or not. Freedom is not whether or not I still technically have a taskmaster. Freedom begins up here. It's the same with Judaism. It's true that there's tremendous importance on what I do. There's tremendous importance on my action. The Jewish people had to do something before they could get out. God is willing to meet us much more than halfway. Are we willing first to come out and meet God? That's a tremendously difficult question that each of us has to answer. And all that begins with mezuzah. And so that brings us full circle back now to what this is here. The power of environment is an incredible thing. And we don't always appreciate how much we're affected by the environment around us. The greatest tragedy of environment is when environment is not a conscious decision. I gotta tell you, because I spent a week now in the army. I can't tell you how much I look forward to just coming home here and having an opportunity to sit and learn Torah again. Because when you're out of that world and you're running around, and some of the people there are even incredibly educated people, magnificent people, but there's always going to be something missing. It's a conscious decision. What you do with your environment. It's interesting that Judaism says one of the most important environments that we have is our home. And each of us has a home. What do I do with that home? And it's interesting, by the way, that the halachot very much reflect some of the goals of that home. I'll give you an example. So if I'm in the army and I'm in a tent, do I put up a mezuzah on that tent? Nope. If I'm in a dwelling, which is temporary, less than 30 days, there's no obligation to put up a mezuzah. That's very interesting. And I could have given you a whole class on why there would be an obligation to put up a mezuzah on the tent. You should make home everywhere you are, you know, it should be there, whatever. Something the Torah says. You have to recognize what home is and what home isn't. Home is stability. Home is who you are, where you are, and where you want to be. And you have to have a stable place in your life, and you have to know where that is. It's interesting that halachically, it begins with the gate. So in America, the way that our system works, we don't really have gates. Here in Israel, we do. As a matter of fact, you walk out of the old city, you see a mezuzah on the gate, you see, that's an incredible idea. There's a message. You walk in Shaar Yafo. You walk in Shaar Tzion, the Zion gate. And there's a message that's given to anyone who cares to listen to it. You are now entering a city. But it's not just any city. This is a Jewish city. It's a city that represents Jewish ideals. It's a city that should speak of Jewish ethics. It's a tremendous challenge. If I walk into New York City and there's garbage on the floor, that's terrible. But if I walk through a mezuzah and see garbage on the floor, that should cause me pain. Whole different perspective. Go you a stage further. What is the educational message that I'm being taught as I come into that home? Well, look at the Shema. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. When I walk into this home, is God to be found in this home? I told you once, they asked the Kutzker Rebbe. The Kutzker Rebbe said, God is wherever you let Him in. Do I feel God in this home? Is this home worthy of a mezuzah? That's a tremendous challenge. Most people build a home and then they put a mezuzah in. Judaism says, you're going to have a mezuzah here. Build a home to meet the standards of that mezuzah. Tremendous. But it doesn't stop there. V'ahavta Hashem Elokecha. Even if there is God in the home, what kind of a relationship do I have with God in this home? Is that a relationship of love? Is it a positive relationship? Ahavat Hashem, love of God, can only stem from love of my fellow human being, because my fellow human being is created in the image of God. If I can't love my fellow human being, says the Kabbalah, I can never learn to love God. Tremendous, tremendous idea. Is this an educational institution? I can't tell you over my years of teaching how many parents I've met who really honestly believe that it's the job of the school to teach their children. How come you're not teaching my children this? How come you're not teaching my children that? I remember once I had a student, and this is when I had a yeshiva. Wonderful, wonderful boy. As a matter of fact, he's now in Israel. He just touched base with me on the night of Shavuot. It was wonderful to see him. And this boy came with a lot of baggage, to put it mildly. And, I mean, just to give you an example, he, about 2 months into the program, said that he had been in 11th grade on marijuana. You know, like once a week or twice a week he would smoke marijuana. He was one of the reasons that I started to do a lot of research into marijuana and its effects on students, because I didn't know much about it. And by the middle of senior year, he was like doing at least a joint a day. I later found out from Rabbi Twersky that in an effort to, I guess, keep people addicted to marijuana, some of the bases of marijuana production in Lebanon, in South America, they've made marijuana so concentrated now that the average reefer that you find in America is like smoking 15 reefers in 1965. You smoke one marijuana reefer today, it's like you smoked 15. So if somebody smokes a couple a day, it's like 30 reefers, 30 joints. So this guy had an experience, which, whatever, it was a long discussion. He had an experience when he was sort of in the middle of his 12th grade year. Somebody came and left and he thought they were still there, and he had a whole conversation with them, and then he had a panic attack. He sort of reached the conclusion that he was doing a little too much marijuana and it frightened him, right? And he sort of lost it for a couple of days. He decided to go cold turkey and to go off marijuana. That's not a simple thing to do, because marijuana, even though they used to think it wasn't addictive, today they know that it is, because it's fat soluble. In other words, it gets stored in the fatty system in the body, and the body detoxes you gradually, which means it takes a long time to get off this. Now, I didn't know this. And he came to me, this is like, I guess, after Sukkot, like October, November time, said he hadn't touched marijuana in 6 months, and he still didn't feel he was a part of the world. He still felt like he was high most of the time. And it was really panicking him. And he had this fear that this marijuana, that this had affected his brain cells, and he was terrified. So, whatever, I had a long discussion with him. In the end, I got him together with Rabbi Twersky, who you've heard me mention, and I learned more than he did, I'm sure. Anyway, so in the course of all these discussions, we moved our dormitories. Whatever. We had a dormitory. We had to give up that dormitory and move to a different apartment. It was actually a better apartment building, but we didn't get it cleaned up on time. And we fumigated the place 2 days before the guys moved in. Now, one of the problems when you fumigate a place is that the roaches come out to check for air. And nobody told me that, you know, if you fumigate a place, you're going to have a lot of roaches for 2 or 3 days. After you fumigate, they're all gone, right? It's not true. They come out to die.
So these guys moved in the evening and they put in all this stuff, and there were like hundreds of roaches crawling all around this place, right? And you can imagine, I mean, these were like, you know, 18-year-olds, whatever. They were not thrilled by this. You know, they're guys. Now, of course, it's not cool for a guy to say he's scared of cockroaches. It's not cool. They found other ways to say this, right? Anyway, I get this call at about 3 a.m. in the morning from America. I thought, oh, my God, what's the emergency? Who passed away? What happened? This woman begins to scream at me on the phone. Like, my wife already knows, you know, if it's a 3 a.m. call, it's probably for you, right? So I get the phone. What's the matter with you? What are you doing with me? Excuse me? Excuse me? Turns out this boy was, you know, just going nutso. Called up his mom. Went bananas about all these roaches. The mom called me up to give me a, you know, good, you know, so, okay, you know, your parents are away. It's very hard. You know, it's very scary for parents very often when the children are far away or whatever. Anyway, during the course of this conversation, I learned a lot about their son. And I started to understand why their son had so many issues to deal with. Right? And it was clear to me that this woman had given me her son to educate. I sent my son to you. I expect you to make him into a mensch. How are you going to do that if you've got cockroaches running around there, right? Okay? So you're beginning to get the idea. Judaism says that's not so. You are your children's teachers. When your child is one day old, school begins, what messages are you going to give your children? You know, my daughter is coming up on her first birthday, Bezrat Hashem, Adi. She was born July 1st, whatever. And that's an unbelievable milestone, that your child is a year old. And it makes you start to think, what has my child gotten in a year? And on the one hand, you know, when your child is an infant, so they're a vegetable. I mean, what do? You know, they're like a doll with extra buttons. You know, like if you go, maybe you'll get a smile. More often than not, it's gas, but whatever, right? So, you know, and now she crawls, and she reacts, and she's starting to say words, but she's still a doll. That's how most people think of it. It's not true. Your child has absorbed so much in a year. What have they absorbed in your house? What are the values that have started sinking in? Like a child, all of a sudden at 4, doesn't turn on an on switch and start to learn. They're basing themselves on what they learned as a 3-year-old. And as a 3-year-old, they're basing themselves on what they learned as a 2-year-old. And if you get a kid who's at 5 years old, has all of these fears, afraid to go to the bathroom, afraid to talk, cries a lot, you know, hits other children, well, that comes from somewhere. What does a child get? I'll tell you something. You walk into a Jewish home, especially your Jewish home. Remember that custom I mentioned? You kiss the mezuzah. You know what that is? That's an unbelievable opportunity. It's an unbelievable opportunity. I come into my house at the end of my day. And no matter who you are, and no matter what you do, no matter how much you love what you do, it doesn't matter. You have baggage from your day. That's just the way life is. And some days it's good baggage, and some days it's not. And you come into your house, and you know, this is going on at work, and this project, etc. And then you kiss your mezuzah and say, wait a second. I'm entering my home now. What do I want to bring in the door with me? In about 10 seconds, my children are going to see their father, who they haven't seen since this morning. So what do I give them? Have I given this thought? This is the most important class of my day. What do I do with that class? What's the class that I'm going to give my child when he comes running up to give me a hug? Am I going to give him what meeting I had today? What do I do? You're a single person, and you're coming into your home. It's your home. What do you do with that? Even if you live on your own, how do I enter my Jewish home? Tremendous idea. So you stop for a moment, and it's an unbelievable opportunity. And you kiss the mezuzah, and you think, what do I want this home to be? What do I want to make of this environment? How do I want people to feel when they come into my home? Do I want them to feel the ahavta, that you should love? Love God, love your fellow human being, love me, love the house. What do I want them to feel? What do I want them to walk away with? Tremendous opportunity. Certain times you walk into a person's home, and when you walk into that home, you just feel you had an enriching experience. I don't know if you've had the privilege while you're here in Israel of having a home like that, or even in America, or wherever. But sometimes you walk into certain people's homes and you leave that home and you feel enriched. You just feel like it wasn't just four walls. There's more to it than that. That's what a mezuzah gives. And I want to tell you something. I think that that's the reason that you don't see the cloth. You don't see the parchment. It's inside. Because if I put a parchment on a wall and it's words, then it's very easy. Then it's black and white. Here are the messages. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It's not so easy. It can't be here. It has to be here. If when I walk into my house, I have to read the Shema, then I've missed something. You know, sometimes students ask me, if I could learn one thing by heart, what would it be? Like if I could learn one text, like learning the whole Torah by heart, that's a lot of work. But if I could learn one text, no hesitation on my part, the Shema. If you could learn the first portion of the Shema by heart, it has everything in it. How to relate to your fellow human being, how to relate to God, everything. And if you find a way, if you make up a tune for the words, it doesn't matter. And you learn to sing it, and you learn to memorize it, magnificent. If you make a decision that when you walk into your house, that the first thing you'll do before anything else, you know, we have like our routines, right? What's your routine? You come home. Well, especially, I mean, I remember before, you know, okay, so what's the first thing you gotta do? You gotta hit the answer machine, right? Because you gotta know. You gotta know! I gotta hit the answer machine. And then I got the fridge. I gotta grab that orange juice. And then I check the mail. Oh yeah, I got the mail, right? So I've got this 10-minute routine, right? You go in, check your mail, check your answer machine, check the fridge, kick off your shoes, turn on the TV, hit the radio, the phone rings, and before you know it, 20 minutes, and what have you really done? Imagine if you had a different routine. I mean, I start my day with an unbelievable routine. It's called Modeh Ani, right? The first prayer you say in your day, first word you say in your day is Modeh, thank you. So I have a routine that goes with that Modeh. What am I thankful for in my life? And the second word you say is Ani, me. Who am I? What do I want to be today? And there's a whole routine. And there's a danger in routines because they become routines. So you have to de-routinize your routine. Same thing when you come home. What do you do with that moment? Because how you begin your entry into your home is going to set the pattern for what your home will be. So I have a different routine. What do I do with that? Do you learn something before you enter your house? Do you kiss your mistress and think, even if it's just for a second? Tremendous idea. And that has very much to do with what a mezuzah is. And it's interesting that as I walk into a Jewish home, what a mezuzah represents is that one time, 3,200 years ago, the Jewish people said to God, we're willing to put it on the line because we want a relationship with you. We're willing to do. We're willing to put on our doorstep that this is a Jewish home. How do I make this into a Jewish home? And I'll give you an answer. I don't have a magic potion for how to make a home a Jewish home. You got to do this to find that potion. Jewish study, Jewish prayer, Jewish evenings, a Jewish Shabbat experience, whatever you decide. You may decide there's no value to having a Jewish home. But all decisions in life have to be conscious decisions. That's what a mezuzah is. And I'll tell you again, you know, a mezuzah is a magnificent, magnificent mitzvah. Because it's the easiest mitzvah you can imagine. It's a one-time mitzvah that you get to enjoy every day for the rest of your life. And I will tell you, by the way, halachically, that the biblical obligation is actually to put a mezuzah on the entrance to the whole house. You know, people sometimes look at a mezuzah, so a parchment can be expensive. It can cost you 15, 20, 25 bucks. And by the way, you're better off buying a $25 parchment and putting it in a plastic container that costs a shekel than spending $25 on the container and having a $2 parchment. That's just as an aside. So you buy one mezuzah, and there's a magnificent bracha. Asher kiddushanu b'mitzvotav v'tzivanu t'yad has commanded us likvo a mezuzah. To set the mezuzah. I'm making a statement. I'm making a statement about how I want to set the tone for this home. Tremendous idea. Now, if you think back to how we began this course of study. So we began by saying that the issue is communications. What do I do with that? What message am I giving myself? That's the challenge of mezuzah. People walk by a mezuzah, they never stop to appreciate what it is. What is it? What's the message that it gives me? What do I want to learn from it? What does it mean, Shomer Daltot Yisrael? If I've developed a relationship with Hashem and Hashem is in this house you will never be alone. That's a tremendous idea. And then I guess the challenge is what you do with that and what it means. In order to fulfill the mitzvah of mezuzah, you have to buy a parchment or get one or borrow one. And on that parchment are words of Torah. So as I enter a Jewish home, I'm involved already in Torah study. So there's some food for thought. And I will tell you one last thing. I mentioned to you before that the door represents transition. You know, there's a magnificent halakha. We light Hanukkah candles inside the home. That's how we do it today. That's actually an aberration that developed as a result of Jewish historical issues. Originally, you were supposed to light the Hanukkah candle outside your home. In fact, the central mitzvah of Hanukkah was Pirsuma Denisa, to publicize the miracle, right? That there was this incredible miracle, we developed a relationship with God, Jews came back, rededicated the temple, and actually the first thing they did when they rededicated the temple was to light a menorah. Tremendous idea. Now there was a certain time when it was dangerous for a Jew to light a menorah outside his home. We were gifted, we're lucky. We live in a generation where this doesn't occur to us. But if you lived in 1942, the big question was, could you light a menorah? So eventually you could light a menorah inside your home. And you weren't allowed, halachically, you could not fulfill the mitzvah of lighting a menorah on your own. It's an incredible mitzvah. Because in order to fulfill the mitzvah of lighting the menorah, the candles for Hanukkah, someone else has to see you light the menorah and partake in the miracle with you. Which you can imagine is an incredible idea. It's a mitzvah which is based on my sharing beauty that I see with someone else. Today we live in an age where that's not so. Where you can now light the menorah and publicize it. So if you live in an apartment building, you can light it on the window in your apartment building so people will see it. And you know, if you ever have the opportunity, if you're walking in New York or Los Angeles, sometimes you'll be walking somewhere and you'll see a menorah in a Jewish home window. It'll just give you a nice feeling like, oh, there's a menorah. I want to tell you here, it's incredible. You walk the streets of the old city, you know, on Israelite, when we have a Hanukkah fall on a program in Israelite. So inevitably, like at the end of Hanukkah candles and whatever we do, there's sort of that period of time where people just walk outside. You walk here, so, I mean, here it's not, oh, look, there's a menorah. Here it's, isn't that interesting? There's a window there without a menorah. Like the windows are full of menorahs. It's unbelievable. All of Yerushalayim. Magnificent. And there's a halacha that when you light the menorah outside your house, which is what you're really supposed to do, right, that you should light it on the right side as you leave the house. Why? Because the mezuzah is on the left side, and the menorah is on the right. And the rabbi said, when you stand in the doorway and light your menorah, you're surrounded by mitzvot. Menorah on one side, and mezuzah on the other. But I want to tell you something else. It's a magnificent commentary. It says, you know, the mitzvah of the menorah is to light candles outwards, so that people outside see the menorah. The mitzvah of the mezuzah is inwards. I put it on my right as I come in. So the mezuzah, even though it represents both directions, begins with entrance. It's very interesting that the tefillin sit on the mezuzah to my soul, when you think about it. On what enters inside of me. And the mezuzah sits on the entrance to my home. That's a tremendous, tremendous gift. What do I do with that? And where do I go with that? You will, each of you, be koveya mezuzah. You will set a doorpost. You will have your doorposts. You'll have the doorposts to your homes. You'll have the doorposts to who you are. And Judaism seems to suggest that what sits on that doorpost is incredibly valuable. You know, people take a lot of thought, what's the sign on the entrance to the office? How do I greet a person when they first meet me? Well, I want to give you another perception. We're all trying somehow, at our different levels and different stages and different directions, to develop a relationship with this thing we call God, whatever that means. I hope, as much as it's difficult to come to conclusions with this topic, at least that there's more direction than there was 3 weeks ago. There's a mezuzah for that as well. Where do I begin? How do I start off? One of the most challenging things you can do when you leave here, if you choose, this is, as I've said so many times to you, is your choice. But if you decide that the environment you found here, that the beauty that Judaism has to offer, is something that you want to continue with, one of the most challenging things you could do, one of the ways you can do that, is to develop a Jewish home. Is to create for yourself somehow a Jewish environment. It's not as difficult as you might think. The real challenge is just giving it thought. And that thought begins with the ideas behind mezuzah. So there's some food for thought. I hope, Bezrat Hashem, on that note, that this place is not now an institute that you came to visit, but is a second home. And will always be a second home. That this mezuzah, you will get to see again and again over the years. And you should know that you're always welcome to come back and check it out. I want to tell you that it has been really a pleasure studying with you guys.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.